Epilogue. The greatest human rights catastrophe of my lifetime. On March 8, 2019, President Trump, stopping to survey tornado damage in Alabama, told the assembled press corps he couldn't get there fast enough about the twister that killed 23 in Lee County nearly a week earlier. "I wanted to come the day it happened," he added about his trip, which he made en route to a previously scheduled weekend getaway at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. But while Trump, sporting a dark windbreaker bearing the presidential seal, got a bird's-eye view of the damage from Marine One, he had something else on his mind: family separations. After he ended the administration's practice of systematically ripping apart migrant families in June 2018, the number of those taken into custody crossing the southern border in July dipped slightly, from 43,180 to 40,149, causing some to argue the policy had worked. Toward the end of the year, the number rose back to the level seen at the end of the Obama administration, and the president was having second thoughts about his decision. By February 2019, the monthly total had skyrocketed to 76,575, a figure not seen since George W. Bush was president, and a sign President Trump's border policies were failing. "This is something the president gets very emotional about," one former senior administration official told me about his obsession over immigration statistics. Trump's aerial tour of the natural disaster began at Fort Benning, Georgia, where Air Force One had landed at 10:43 a.m. local time. After deplaning behind him, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson, dressed in a long black coat, and Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, wearing high heels, hustled past a phalanx of aides and ahead of the president and First Lady Melania Trump to board Marine One. They were part of his official entourage touring the devastation. With all on board, the presidential helicopter took off moments later for a 17-minute flight to Auburn University Regional Airport across the state line. Outside their rectangular windows were scenes of flattened trees, destroyed buildings, and wrecked cars. Distracted, the president brought up family separations. "Kirstjen, we're going to have to reinstitute that," Trump declared while tornado victims awaited him with open arms and raised cell phones on the ground, as NBC affiliate KPLC reported. "Sir," Nielsen began, "I'm not sure I can reinstitute this on my own," she said, attempting to end the conversation. It wasn't the first occasion the president had brought up restarting family separations since he was forced to end them, and it wouldn't be the last. But this time, the conversation was put to bed not by the president, nor either cabinet secretary on board his chopper. "We can't do that. We can't do that," Melania Trump cut in, curtailing any debate. It wasn't the first time the First Lady voiced her opposition to family separations. In June 2018, at the height of the outrage over the policy, her spokeswoman said, "Mrs. Trump hates to see children separated from their families," and that she believes we need to be a country that follows all laws, but also a country that governs with heart. Trump, frustrated, rolled his eyes at the interjection by the sneaker and peacoat-clad First Lady, but did not argue back. Instead, the president sighed. "We'll see. We'll see," he said. The following morning, the border numbers were still on President Trump's mind. From Mar-a-Lago, he turned to Twitter. "Border Patrol and law enforcement has apprehended, captured, large numbers of illegal immigrants at the border," Trump wrote. "They won't be coming into the U.S. The wall is being built and will greatly help us in the future and now." Exactly 1 month later, Trump fired Nielsen. After my colleagues Julia Ainslie and Jeff Bennett reported their falling out was due in part to Nielsen's reluctance to restart family separations, something Trump had for months urged his administration to reinstate, Trump responded, "We're not looking to do that, no," he said at the White House. Trump then qualified his statement, "When you don't do it, It brings a lot more people to the border. The night Juan arrived in Washington, D.C. to be reunified with Jose, Katie Waldman, Nielsen's spokeswoman at the Department of Homeland Security, who relentlessly defended family separations, enjoyed her birthday dinner at the Trump International Hotel at a table for two. It was October 3rd, 2018. 20 days later, she was on the border again, still mugging for Instagram, this time in Arizona, behind a plaque that indicated the boundary between the United States and Mexico. Behind her appeared to be the same corrals that Juan and Jose passed through and over before they found themselves in the United States. "The border wall is on the American side," her caption read, a huge smile on her face at the place where Juan and Jose's lives changed forever. Later that year, after Katie Turr and I started filming American Swamp, our MSNBC documentary series about corruption in Washington, we met Waldman for dinner in D.C. On an unseasonably warm December night, we sat outside under space heaters. Turr, who was 5 months pregnant, asked Waldman about defending zero tolerance on behalf of the Trump administration. "My family and colleagues told me that when I have kids, I'll think about the separations differently. But I don't think so." It was a line Waldman had said to me before, prior to visiting the detention facilities. "DHS sent me to the border to see the separations for myself, to try to make me more compassionate. But it didn't work." "It didn't work?" "I will never forget what I saw. Seriously, are you a white nationalist?" I asked, exasperated. "No, but I believe if you come to America, you should assimilate. Why do we need to have Little Havana?" Waldman, a native of Fort Lauderdale, grew up living side by side with Cuban Americans in South Florida, a group of people whose lives couldn't be more intertwined with the culture and politics of the region. Neither Katie Turr nor I knew what to say. Turr, flabbergasted, got up and went to the restroom. When she left, Waldman leaned in and in a hushed tone asked me a question. "You know who I'm dating, right?" "We all know," I told her, about one of the biggest open secrets in D.C. When Turr returned to the table, I laughed, telling her in front of Waldman that she wanted us to know who she was dating. "Jacob told me before you got here," Turr deadpanned. Today, Waldman and her then-boyfriend, Stephen Miller, the architect of the family separation policy and the senior advisor to President Trump, are married. After leaving DHS, Waldman worked briefly for Arizona Senator Martha McSally, and she's now the press secretary to Vice President Mike Pence. Turr and I ran into Waldman a year later at a Trump election rally in Hershey, Pennsylvania, as we were shooting another episode of American Swamp. Vice President Pence was there to introduce the president on the same day articles of impeachment were introduced against Trump in the House of Representatives. We congratulated her on her engagement and new job and asked how things were going. She was elated and told us she was going to meet up backstage with Miller for 30 minutes, the most time they would see each other all week. Before the rally started, I asked her about a report from the DHS Inspector General that had come out just more than 2 weeks earlier, which confirmed that, quote, DHS did not have the information technology system functionality needed to track separated migrant families during the execution of the zero tolerance policy. A surprise to no one. There was a shocking revelation in the report, however. CBP, which officially separated 2,814 during zero tolerance, then later admitted it separated 1,556 more before the policy officially started, told the Office of Management and Budget, quote, it had planned to separate more than 26,000 children between May and September 2018. If the policy had not been stopped, this would have been a massive increase in the total number of separations, and with the report, our understanding of the scale of the tragedy widened. Since the supposed end of family separations, the ACLU alleged, there have been more than 1,000 separations, and the practice is still ongoing. I asked Waldman, as we stood there behind the press riser that President Trump would later point to and ridicule, if she knew about the fact the government was planning to separate 5 times more children than it had ultimately been able to before the president backed down. "We had to prepare for all contingencies," she deadpanned. And with that, she went backstage to see her fiancé. The night after Christmas 2019, I sat down with Juan and Jose for dinner near their home, the third time I had seen them since I started writing this book. They always asked for updates on my progress and the first copy. I told them about my attempts to determine and visit exactly where they crossed as I visited the border between San Luis Rio Colorado, Mexico, and San Luis, Arizona. I had spent an entire day driving up and down along the Arizona border, looking for what Juan had described to me earlier, white horse corrals and a short border fence. I told the Border Patrol I was going to be there, and they attempted to point me in the right direction. I believe I eventually found the exact area. Juan and Jose recounted what it was like to jump over the wall and within a minute have the Border Patrol waiting for them and the rest of the families they crossed with. The vast majority of our conversations were now in English, Jose's improving particularly fast as he went to school and spent extracurricular time learning the vocational skills of an electrician. Juan showed me the Social Security card and work permit he had received just that day, and we high-fived. We video chatted with Maria, his wife, and his now 3 daughters, his wife bottle-feeding the youngest, whom Juan and Jose had never met. They freely laughed together. Everything felt loose, and for the first time I was able to ask them both candid questions about the moment of separation itself. Jose, who had been reluctant to say anything in our previous conversations, described it almost exactly. Turning away from his son, who was sitting next to him in the booth, both of them across from me about the same distance Juan and I sat across from each other inside the Adelanto migrant prison, Juan started to sob. He hung his head in shame, recalling the particulars of the day they were separated without warning or a chance to say goodbye. Jose kept a straight face, his 15-year-old frame now much bigger than the pictures I had seen of the scrawny kid in his dad's store. "Harming children means a century of suffering," a government official who was involved in the reunification effort told me the following morning at a Starbucks outside of Washington, D.C. "It's the greatest human rights catastrophe of my lifetime," the official explained, referring to domestic U.S. history while rocking back and forth. While there was plenty of blame to go around, the official told me without flinching that former colleague Scott Lloyd is the most prolific child abuser in modern American history. The official believed Lloyd, head of the agency supposedly responsible for the welfare of migrant children placed in its custody, had abdicated his legal parental authority and custodianship of more than 5,000 children. Lloyd was, quote, starry-eyed around Stephen Miller, yet was blind to warnings coming from his own staff. Lloyd, in a written response, told me he was taken aback by the accusation of child abuse. "There is nothing anyone can point to that would make that statement true. My job was to take care of the kids and unite them with a sponsor. It's something we did well, and I'm proud of the work we did. This person, whoever it is, had the opportunity to air their concerns in person while these events were happening, but instead is choosing to speak anonymously through the media 2 years after the fact. It is a comment that clearly belies everything I have ever done in my professional and personal life. Given all of this, it's impossible for me to take it seriously." Lloyd was transferred out of ORR into an HHS office overseeing faith-based initiatives in November 2018, after the end of Zero Tolerance. In February 2019, he was called before the newly sworn-in Democratic Congress to answer questions about his time at the helm of ORR. Appearing before the House Judiciary Committee, Lloyd was asked by Texas Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee about whether he had ordered the destruction of the list tracking separated children first reported by Politico's Dan Diamond in October 2018. It had been reported in the press, Lee began, that during an internal HHS review of the family separation policy, a top HHS official found that you instructed your staff to stop keeping a spreadsheet tracking separated families. Did you make this decision, and if so, why? Why in the world would you choose to make a decision like this? As a father yourself, can you explain to us how this possibly could have happened? Lloyd, dressed in a red tie and now sporting a full beard, more mountain man than choir boy, sat with his fingers interlaced on top of the witness table and began to respond. Thank you, Congresswoman. That was an incorrect reporting. I did not make that, Lloyd paused and looked down. He searched for his next word, having been sworn in under oath. Order, he said. Before he could continue, Lee moved on, asking Lloyd about proposed shelters in her district. Lloyd was asked again about the incident by Diamond in October 2019 after he had left the Trump administration entirely. There was a list, Lloyd explained to Diamond. I knew of the list, he said, contradicting what he told his staff. The list ended up leaking to the media, so really my direction was about how we communicate about the kids on the list. Meanwhile, at the Starbucks, for nearly 2 hours, the government official and I discussed the intimate details of the separation policy's development, implementation, and aftermath, the official alternating between anger, remorse, and determination as we ticked through 2 years of dates and events while I attempted to better understand what I, in the summer of 2018, had seen. Hundreds of children locked up in cages after being taken from their parents, then moved alone, often for months, to shelters. Though most of the separated children had been reunited with their parents by then, a year and a half after a federal judge ordered the government to put all of the families back together, there were still moms and dads who had been deported without their kids. They had still not been reunited. Additionally, one final child was still in the custody of the federal government. The same day, after a 30-minute drive that took me across two rivers, I slid into a booth with a former Department of Homeland Security official who wanted to unburden himself. We should have done better to explain what was happening, he said about DHS's response to the public outrage over the crisis. Meanwhile, the White House was putting impossible pressure on the agency. Despite that, this person, directly involved not just in the reunifications but the separations themselves, wanted me to know that he regretted being a part of the policy. This was the greatest mistake from a law enforcement and human perspective in my career. If I could go back and change it, I would. It was wrong. As he spoke, he polished off a bowl of grains topped with salmon. He had come to this opinion even though he believed data showed, quote, it was working. By this, he meant the separation policy was, quote, deterring families from coming into the country. That's exactly what President Trump wanted all along and why he had pressured Kirstjen Nielsen to restart the practice. It was hard to argue that the shocking cruelty of the Trump administration's separation policy wasn't integral to achieving their objectives. The following month, in early January 2020, both Katie Waldman and her former boss, Jonathan Hoffman, now a spokesperson at the Department of Defense, were in the news. They were issuing statements that Iran fired ballistic missiles at a military base in Iraq in response to President Trump's ordered assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. The people who were in charge of the most spectacular policy fail of the Trump administration were now in charge of communicating whether or not the nation was about to go to war. As 2020 continued, Waldman added to her portfolio the government's public relations response to the global pandemic known as COVID-19. She again would find herself working with some of the same public health professionals at the Department of Health and Human Services she repeatedly clashed with during family separations and the court-ordered effort to reunify them. Waldman and Hoffman's departures from DHS hadn't moderated the Trump administration's immigration policies. Since Zero Tolerance, nothing had captured the attention of the nation like that June 2018 did. What the deterrence-based immigration policy championed by the Trump administration since that first meeting on Valentine's Day 2017, and to differing degrees by previous presidential administrations before it, has continued to be deployed at a rapid clip. Some activists argue that what is happening today is as bad, if not worse, than family separations. Migrants who make it here and prove a credible fear, like Juan and Jose did, are now made to wait in Mexico, and tens of thousands of them are doing just that in some of the most violent cities in one of the most violent countries in the world. Reports of rapes, murders, kidnappings, and families self-separating in order to have the best chance at survival are commonplace. They are the lucky ones. Other migrants are being deported immediately to seek asylum in Central America under agreements that place them directly back into harm's way, if not the specific harm they fled. COVID-19 threw the entire immigration system into further chaos, President Trump using it as justification for, amongst other things, his border wall and immediately expelling virtually all asylum seekers, including children. COVID allowed Trump to quickly enact what DHS was trying to do for 3 years, a government official quipped to me. As I write this, I'm watching with the rest of the world as the Trump administration bungles its response to COVID-19. Many of the officials showing up at the once-again daily White House press briefings were names and faces heretofore unfamiliar to most of the American public. Not to me. Chad Wolf. Alexander Azar. Dr. Robert Kadlec. Katie Waldman. All of them are central figures in the Trump administration's widely criticized response to the ongoing global pandemic. But before that, they were central figures in the Trump administration's family separation policy. Names you've now read and learned about here. Waldman, now Katie Miller, herself tested positive for COVID-19 in May 2020. Raising concerns about a potential White House outbreak and sending top officials into self-isolation. While reporting this book and after the height of the family separation policy, I traveled twice to Guatemala to see conditions on the ground there myself. We visited villages where many had picked up and left because of extreme poverty, food insecurity, and violence. Before my trips, I learned from a former government official that the Trump administration had pulled foreign aid to Guatemala, despite the fact they knew the aid would slow migration, the Trump administration's goal. Back in D.C. over breakfast, I told this person and another immigration official about Juan and Jose, who were from Petén, Guatemala. They looked at each other and laughed. I was confused. "What's so funny about Petén?" I asked. "Nothing, nothing," they both said. I mentioned that I knew about the narco violence there, the secret airports used by smugglers, and the violence that Juan and Jose faced before leaving to come here. Before we left the restaurant, I pressed them again about their reaction to my invoking Petén, and they said nothing. Days later, I saw an article in the Washington Post, and it all made sense. Asylum seekers rejected by the United States could be transported to a remote airport in the lowland jungles of Guatemala, as part of the Central American nation's new migration accord with the Trump administration, according to senior officials from both countries, the Post's Nick Muroff and Kevin Seif reported. The plan would have U.S. immigration authorities deliver migrants to Petén's Mundo Maya Airport, which is used primarily by tourists visiting the Maya ruins at Tikal. I texted one of the two officials at breakfast that day. "No wonder you guys laughed about Petén." I didn't get a response. Maybe I should have been more explicit about how foul I thought their reaction was, laughing after learning that a separated father and son I was getting to know could be sent back to where they fled death threats. Reporting on family separations was never the plan, but as the realities on the ground became shockingly clear, my colleagues and I found ourselves consumed by the story. After the media furor died down, we continued our focus on the Trump administration's immigration policies. Julia Ainslie and I kept working closely together, breaking several stories that exposed the hypocrisy and brutality of the administration's policies. After family separation, at least 7 migrant children died in the custody of Customs and Border Protection. No child had perished in the previous 10 years. A sadly predictable outcome to a punitive Border Patrol enforcement strategy based around consequence delivery or prevention through deterrence. It was an outcome that an activist with No More Deaths, a humanitarian group that leaves water bottles for migrants in the Arizona desert, told me had happened before and would happen again so long as the border was militarized. Later in the year, as family separation ended and cartels exploited the perceived weakness of President Trump, who had backed down from the policy, a record number of families and unaccompanied children entered the United States, overflowing Border Patrol stations. Reports emerged of horrid conditions, including children locked up for days, as Jose was, far beyond the 72-hour limit. Julia and I broke a story about the badly overcrowded Yuma, Arizona Border Patrol station, the same one Juan and Jose were separated in. We were leaked more than 30 reports of alleged abuse of minors in custody there, including a sexual assault and retribution for protesting conditions. To this day, Customs and Border Protection has not released the result of the investigations it opened into those allegations based on our reporting. When I went back to Yuma to look into where Juan and Jose had crossed, I also asked the Border Patrol for an official interview with the sector chief, who had promised to investigate the claims we had revealed in our reporting. At first, it looked promising. The local public information officer told me he was going to run it up the flagpole to headquarters in Washington, and he would let me know a time to come back. I checked in after having not heard anything. "Good morning, Mr. Soboroff. We will not be able to accommodate your request for any engagements until further notice. We appreciate you reaching out. Thank you." At least on this trip, as I worked to excavate details from the separation of Juan and Jose and follow up about abuse in the Border Patrol station in which they were held, I wasn't so welcome in Yuma after all. But in January 2020, when Kevin McAleenan, who had succeeded Kirstjen Nielsen as acting Homeland Security Secretary, was himself succeeded as acting secretary by Chad Wolf, who had authored an early version of the justification for family separations, I would finally be invited to officially visit Yuma. The trip, however, would be to watch Wolf discuss how President Trump was, finally, building stretches of his big, beautiful border wall. I didn't go. Following Wolf's visit to Yuma, the Border Patrol named a new chief, Rodney Scott. The same Rodney Scott who had penned me a letter accusing me and our network of covering family separations as a made-for-TV drama. Today, he is the man in charge of the nation's border force and its thousands of agents who were tasked with the unprecedented mission of separating thousands of migrant families. The same agents now responsible for a suffering so profound it will last a lifetime. A month after Scott's appointment as Border Patrol chief, Physicians for Human Rights, a nonprofit group that shared the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize for its efforts to ban landmines, issued a scathing report about the Trump administration's family separation policy. In it, the group declares the, quote, "government's forcible separation of asylum-seeking families constitutes cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment, and, in all cases PHR evaluated, meets criteria for torture." Torture. Despite the warnings, the evidence, the journalism, and the public outcry, torture was not a word I had used to describe what I had seen with my own eyes. But that's exactly what it was. U.S. officials, the group wrote, intentionally carried out discriminatory actions that caused severe pain and suffering in order to punish, coerce, and intimidate Central American asylum seekers to give up their asylum claims. By their measure, the Trump administration succeeded in one respect: the act of separations and the damage it caused to thousands of parents and children. But where they failed, and will continue to fail, was to quash the determination, perseverance, and love that those they tortured share. Look no further than Juan and Jose, who on the contrary didn't give up their asylum claims once they were separated and reunited. They only fought harder. Their claims are now being adjudicated separately by the United States government. Once they're able to clear the massive backlog of cases, and if President Trump's new policies don't stop them again, Juan and Jose hope to achieve their dream of becoming legal permanent residents and then citizens of the United States. If and when that happens, likely no sooner than within the next 3 years because of the massive case backlog, the father and son dream of having their family join them here. They dream of holding the newest, youngest member of their family, a baby girl, for the first time. Here, in the country that represented safety and opportunity, only to give way to immeasurable pain and unexpected suffering. Now, once again, at the dawn of a new beginning, the United States is home to what they had hoped it would be when they approached the international boundary in Arizona: the possibility of a better future and life together for them all. Acknowledgements. There's no question who deserves my deepest gratitude: Juan and Jose. Through their unimaginable trauma and the ongoing separation from the rest of their nuclear family, they chose to allow me to drop into their lives on a regular basis. They always had one selfless goal: to figure out together how what happened to them did, so that it would not happen to anyone ever again. I thank them for their selflessness and friendship. Rest assured, my promise will be kept, and they'll get the first copy of this book. I would not have met Juan and Jose were it not for the indefatigable Lindsay Tislowski, who, by simply letting me watch her and her colleagues work on Juan's behalf, taught me that immigration attorneys are as important as any first responder on any front line. Peter Hubbard, vice president and editorial director at HarperCollins Custom House, formerly an executive editor at William Morrow, is the man responsible for this book. He has been an extraordinary guide, partner, and friend. The magic he worked on this text and his constant encouragement to focus on the people in this story, not the politics or process of separations, has helped me tackle a challenge I would have never known how to start, let alone complete. I am profoundly grateful to him, as well as to his phenomenal HarperCollins Custom House colleagues, including but not limited to Liat Stelik, Maureen Cole, Molly Gendel, Kaylee George, Suzanne Franco Mitchell, Andrea Molitor, and Kelly Rudolph. I would not be in the position to write this story were it not for my teammates at NBC News and MSNBC. Phil Griffin took a chance on a guy with zero broadcast news experience in 2015, offering me a job as an MSNBC correspondent. Andy Lack made it official. Noah Oppenheim welcomed me to the network with open arms. I've had many bosses in my nearly 5 years at 30 Rock who have all enabled and empowered me to color outside the lines. Special thanks is due to Janelle Rodriguez and Betsy Corona, who adroitly and affectionately shepherded our team through the period I write about here. That team is the small reporting unit built together with producers Arnie Hakala and Mitch Koss. Mitch came with me to MSNBC and has been my journalism guru as long as I've reported on TV. Arnie jumped on board wholeheartedly with more than a decade of institutional knowledge of NBC News under his belt and is the glue that keeps us together. Our team also includes some of the best in the business behind the camera at NBC News: Dana Roker, who shoots as beautifully as any Hollywood DP, often without the opportunity to do a retake, and Robert Colville and Craig Nilsson, who are able to pick up the tiniest of sounds to make the biggest of emotional impacts. We are all supported relentlessly by the NBC News Los Angeles Bureau, led by the steady hands and compassionate hearts of Polly Powell and Zoya Taylor. Thank you as well to the lengthy list of top-notch NBC News and MSNBC writers, reporters, producers, editors, and crew members we collaborated with as we reported this story. Our work would not have made it on air were it not for the uniquely talented and supportive people behind the scenes at Today, Nightly, Morning Joe, AM Joy, MSNBC Dayside, and MSNBC Primetime, especially All In with Chris Hayes. I'm deeply appreciative to them all for sharing their airtime with us for original reporting. Special thanks, too, to David Verdi and his team for keeping a watchful eye over us in the field. Whatever we were reporting on, I could always count on Mark Kornblau, Ali Zelenko, Errol Cockfield, Lori Asio, Holly Trace, and their teammates to help us get the word out. Same goes for the amazingly talented marketing group led by Aaron Taylor. Julia Ainslie was and still is my partner in border coverage, tag-teaming from Washington during the separation crisis and on the twists and turns since. She broke the separation story and several other huge pieces of news I write about here. Julia taught me how to actually report. That is, work sources to get to the bottom of what it was I was seeing on the ground. She's dogged, intrepid, and couldn't be a kinder, more generous person. I'm so lucky to know and work with her and her fellow members of our investigative unit. To Rich Greenberg and Mark Shoney, thank you for letting me contribute and supporting the work. The Dateline team, led by Liz Cole and David Corvo, inexplicably turned to this still green correspondent to tackle the giant issue of border politics. Paul Ryan, Izar Harpaz, and Simon Doolittle trusted me to tell a story they conceived. I'll never forget our experience together on the dividing line, nor everyone who assembled the hour on paper and in the edit room. A double thank you to Liz, who along with Phil Griffin asked me to pair up with Katie Turr and a superb team for our MSNBC documentary series, American Swamp. Katie has not only been a co-host and a friend since we were teenagers growing up together in Los Angeles, but a mentor as I wrote this book, never hesitating to share the lessons she learned in writing Unbelievable. She also introduced me to Ben Phelan, who helped me fact-check what you've heard here. Thank you as well to Richard Chacon of the NBC News Standards team for his thoughtful reading of the text. Any errors which slip through the cracks are on me. I'm grateful as well to Alan Berger and Jonathan Lyons, whose advice and counsel I relied on as I embarked on this project. R. Andrew Free skillfully consulted as I attempted to navigate the labyrinth of pulling documents out of the government. Each and every source who provided even a single detail for this book are the real tellers of this story. Everyone from Ranger Kelly Cummins at the Resaca de la Palma State Park in Brownsville, who helped me identify a bird call, to those who could not go on the record. Thank you for the countless hours you spent with me going over and over and over what happened and where to look to understand why. To the Soboroffs, Mom, Dad, Miles, Molly, Hannah, Leah, plus their families, my in-laws the Careys, Rosa, and everyone else in my little family's universe, we would be lost without you. To Nicole, Noah, and Lucia, who watched me write this book through a pregnancy and then a global pandemic, I love you more than you'll ever know. Thank you for sacrificing your husband and dad for hours on end to the writing vortex of the home office laundry room. Now that I'm done, I'll still be in here, just washing clothes. Notes on sourcing. As I recount in my author's note, this book grew out of my real-time reporting for NBC News and MSNBC about immigration policy on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. When I set out to tell the story of family separations, what happened and how, in the breadth and depth a book affords, the first thing I did was go back to that material, including but not limited to reports I filed on air and online, and the pen and paper notes I took during Zero Tolerance. Next, I circled back with people I met that critical week in June 2018 and in its wake. Most were eager to introduce me to other key players I might have heard of, but had never met or spoken with at length. I went through the timeline of events with each of them. They pointed me to other sources, who pointed me to documents, transcripts, recordings, and places to visit. What it became was an exercise in reporting on what I had already reported on, and realizing how much more of a story there was to tell. Were it not for those who decided to step forward, most on the condition of anonymity to protect themselves and others, over a year after President Trump's man-made disaster, to recount to me in great and specific detail private conversations about the planning, execution, and reversal of the family separation policy, understanding my own blind spots and giving you as full and complete a picture as I have attempted to would not have been possible. More often than not, I was surprised to learn sources who were battling each other at the time recalled events similarly, and instead disputes were about the underlying motivation for actions, not debating what actually occurred. It's hard to argue with documented evidence, and there was plenty of it. But when what I was hearing from sources did conflict, I've noted that here. I relied, too, on the incredible work of so many other journalists and organizations for background information and details I did not know, which I attempted to cite within the text as much as possible. You'll find details of what I did not or could not in what follows. If any errors are contained in these pages, they're mine and mine alone. Prologue. This is a story about policy, but also about people. Juan and Jose could not have been more generous with their time, including the details that make up the prologue. When I reached out to Juan for the first time after starting the book to ask him if he would participate, he didn't think twice. While I was researching and writing, the three of us shared delicious meals together, laughing, learning, and sometimes crying. But he was always clear about his motivation for our time together, to make sure what happened to him and his son never happened to anyone ever again. Juan was an open book, helping me paint the picture of his life in Guatemala over those meals by sharing private photographs, text messages, documents about his and Jose's ordeal, and introducing me to their new lawyers working to win their asylum cases. I ended up traveling to his country while writing the book on assignment for NBC. But while I was there, he and his wife Maria decided it would be too dangerous for them to have me visit her. So instead, we met virtually via video conference during one of our meals. Chapter 1. I just couldn't do that. Obama administration officials faced their own crises at the border. And while the administration rejected any attempts to systematically separate families, the way they responded set the stage for what the Trump administration carried out. Nevertheless, many of them, including former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson and Domestic Policy Council Chair Cecilia Munoz, were more than willing to tell me about how family separations were specifically considered and rejected during their tenure in the White House. As they were grappling with what to do on the border, I was an inexperienced campaign reporter. To piece together the day I came face to face with Stephen Miller, whom Munoz would later sit side by side with in a transitional meeting, I relied on the reporting of my NBC News colleague, Benji Sarlin, as well as a live blog of the event by Jennifer Kearns at ColoradoPolitics.com. The email from James Jim De La Cruz, the Office of Refugee Resettlement employee, warning of family separations at the end of the Obama administration, was first reported by the Center for Public Integrity in December 2019 and obtained in a Freedom of Information request, according to CIR, quote, submitted to Health and Human Services by the American Immigration Council, the National Immigrant Justice Center, Kids in Need of Defense, the Women's Refugee Commission, and the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project. Chapter 2. I don't have those numbers. This chapter documents the confusion around early family separations during the Trump administration. As I was reporting from the inauguration, then on drugs at the border and the specter of deportations, discussion of family separation began almost immediately. My now colleague Julia Ainsley reported on March 3, 2017 in her Reuters piece, Trump Administration Considering Separating Women, Children at Mexico Border, that as early as February 2, 2017, it was being discussed. The details I learned about the February 14, 2017 Valentine's Day meeting, which was publicly confirmed by Commander Jonathan White in congressional testimony before the democratically controlled House Energy and Commerce Committee on February 7, 2019, were from multiple officials present. Statistics in this chapter about migration came from the Pew Research Center, and the quotes from Jeff Sessions and Steve Bannon's 2015 conversation about U.S. immigration were reported by Brian Tashman for Right Wing Watch, a project for People for the American Way, in an article called Jeff Sessions Also Misled the Senate About His Civil Rights Record. Commander White's July 4, 2017 memo warning of potential family separations was obtained by the Energy and Commerce Committee, to whom I am grateful for spending an afternoon on Capitol Hill going through a binder full of these emails with me, as was the August 15, 2017 email he received about a rise in separations over the summer, which turned out to be the El Paso pilot program. Chapter 3, A Significant Increase. When the first clues about widespread family separation started to emerge, details were hard to come by. My characterizations of Commander White's attempts to stop a wide-scale family separation policy are based on interviews with multiple people who knew or worked with him personally, but also on primary source material that shows clearly what he was up to. His email to Scott Lloyd, his Trump-appointed boss, flagging what he learned about Operation Mega, which came from Julia Ainslie's exclusive piece with our colleague Andrew Blankstein on September 7, 2017, Homeland Security Plans Massive Roundups of Undocumented Immigrants, was obtained by House Energy and Commerce. The fascinating details revealed by Chris Meekins, the then Chief of Staff to the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response at Health and Human Services, about what the agency is supposed to be preparing for, including a COVID-19-like pandemic, not family separations, were from a January 2019 episode of Dan Diamond's Politico Pulse podcast. What was happening in the HHS Secretary's Operations Center during preparations for Hurricane Irma came from government press releases and handout photos. The details about how Homestead, Florida, was bracing for the storm and how it had fared during Hurricane Andrew came from the Miami Herald and the South Dade News Leader. Scott Lloyd's memo to Steve Wagner about keeping open the temporary ORR shelter in Homestead was a House Energy and Commerce document, as was Commander White's November email to Acting CBP Commissioner McAleenan about an increase in referrals of separated children. The follow-up email sent by McAleenan, Acting Border Patrol Chief Carla Provost, and Deputy Chief Gloria Chavez were obtained by the watchdog group American Oversight. President Trump's quote about working on a plan for DACA was reported by Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Yamiche Alcindor in the New York Times article, Trump's Support for Law to Protect Dreamers Lifts Its Chances. It was KQED's Alexandra Hall who, in haunting detail, described in her report seeking asylum at the California border in the basement cells at San Ysidro Port of Entry, what Miss L and her daughter likely went through. Details of the funeral of an El Paso Border Patrol agent were reported by the Associated Press, and images of it were taken by Ivan Pierre Aguirre and published by the San Diego Express News. Lomi Creel's reporting about the existence of the El Paso pilot program was game-changing, and its importance cannot be overstated. Her piece, Trump Moves to End Catch and Release, Prosecuting Parents and Removing Children Who Cross Border, on November 25, 2017, was groundbreaking. The December conversation between the Border Patrol's Gloria Chavez and an ORR staffer was documented in an email, and details of the after-action report about what she was discussing were revealed in a report by the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General on December 1, 2019. Senator Kamala Harris's back and forth with Kirstjen Nielsen when she was nominated to become Homeland Security Secretary was published by the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, and I'm grateful to her staff for answering questions I had about it. Jean Hamilton and Chad Wolf's emails planning for a family separation policy were first reported on January 17, 2019, by Julia Ainslie in the report, Trump Admin, Wade Targeting Migrant Families, Speeding Up Deportation of Children. She followed up on that report in October 2019 with another one, Trump Admin Considering Chad Wolf, an Author of Family Separation Policy, for DHS Chief. Chapter 4. Very, Very Worried. As more people became aware of family separations occurring, concern mounted behind the scenes. I've never been inside Health and Human Services headquarters, but the U.S. General Services Administration, which maintains the building for the federal government, has more information than you could ever imagine about it online. I learned of the stakeholder meeting held there by the Office of Refugee Resettlement in the batch of documents published by House Energy and Commerce, and contacted one of the organizations on the list to find out more. KIND, Kids in Need of Defense, was in the room, and their representative Jennifer Podkull shared extensive details with me about the meeting, as did ORR sources who were present. It was Melissa Del Bosque's reporting about the Trump administration's plans to build border wall on a wildlife refuge in South Texas that brought us there, particularly her November 10, 2017 report, Records Show Where Trump Plans to Build Texas Border Wall. The Border Patrol email from Gloria Chavez to Commander White was a House Energy and Commerce production, as was his reply. Lee Gallant, the ACLU lawyer, has always been generous with his time and provided context for me around what was publicly known and reported about his Miss L lawsuit. I learned about the phone call in which a critical IT glitch was discussed that would prevent reunifications of separated families from House Energy and Commerce. But it was Claire Trickler-McNulty and Andrew Lorenzen-Strait, two former ICE officials, who helped fill in the details about what it meant. So too did the DHS OIG report. DHS lacked technology needed to successfully account for separated migrant families, published in November 2019. Emails between DHS Secretary Nielsen and her staff were uncovered by American oversight. Statistics about migrant deaths in Arizona came from the Calibri Center for Human Rights, No More Deaths, and La Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Chapter 5. Get Rid of the List. Trump political appointees and career government officials approach family separations completely differently. The extraordinary back and forth between HHS and New York Times reporter Caitlin Dickerson was revealed in a lengthy email exchange produced by House Energy and Commerce. Its timing squared with what I had heard from multiple sources about then-ORR Director Scott Lloyd's desire for a subordinate to destroy the list of separated children he was keeping. Nailing down what happened there was a challenge. And key details about what was said in the ORR coordinating meeting were confirmed by several officials who were present. Neither HHS nor ACF would issue an official statement for the record about the meeting, nor its aftermath. The existence of the decision memo presented to Secretary Nielsen was first reported by the Washington Post's Maria Sacchetti on April 26, 2018, in her piece, Top Homeland Security Officials Urge Criminal Prosecution of Parents Crossing Border with Children. Nielsen ultimately signed it, instituting family separations on May 5, 2018. But the document itself was not published until September 25, 2018, by the Project for Government Oversight. I obtained a copy from a source who had received it too, while writing, and the same source gave me a copy of the legal memo authored by John Mitnick, the general counsel of the Department of Homeland Security, the details of which had never been previously revealed. The briefing document Secretary Nielsen received about the interview I was going to do with her, the same day as the cabinet meeting in which she was eviscerated by President Trump, was obtained by BuzzFeed's Jason Leopold, my former colleague at the Huffington Post, who shared it with me. Details I reported about that cabinet meeting came from an administration official who was present. Trump's berating of Nielsen in the meeting was first reported by the New York Times in an article by Michael D. Scheer and Nicole Perlroth, Kirsten Nielsen, Chief of Homeland Security, almost resigned after Trump tirade. Data about capacity issues within border facilities came from the aforementioned November 2019 DHS OIG report. The warning sent about family separations occurring in Arizona was uncovered by the Center for Public Integrity's FOIA request to HHS. Chapter 6, These Kids Are Incarcerated. This chapter was a pivotal moment for Juan and Jose, and myself. It's when we all learned painful truths about family separations firsthand. Their crossing into the United States was based on details they described to me, a trip I took to the United States side of the border in Yuma and San Luis, Arizona, to investigate in November 2019, and reviewing of Google Maps images of the area with them personally. The number of migrants dying on the Barry Goldwater Air Force bombing range were reported on August 15, 2018, by investigative journalist John Carlos Frey on the independent television news program Democracy Now!, which I've been watching since my college professor Bertel Ullman told me to start in 2002. Details of Juan and Jose's apprehension and detention were culled from documents obtained via Freedom of Information Act requests to the Department of Homeland Security, which I would have never been able to figure out were it not for the Nashville immigration attorney R. Andrew Free, who fought as doggedly for details about Juan and Jose's case as he does for his clients. The email from Jim De La Cruz to his colleagues, the night of Juan and Jose's apprehension, was part of the batch the Center for Public Integrity obtained via FOIA. I have never been to the Florence Detention Center, where Juan was sent from Yuma, but the Florence Project and attorney Laura St. John helped me understand how it works. Vice's reporting, particularly the June 27, 2018 piece by Taylor Dolvin, five federal prisons are being asked to accept hundreds of migrants under the zero-tolerance immigration policy, provided important details about the federal prison in Victorville, where Juan ended up next. Details of my tour of Casa Padre in Brownsville came directly from my little blue notebook and were all observations I made in real time while touring on June 13, 2018. The email sent by Commander White to the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Health on June 15, 2018 came from House Energy and Commerce. Chapter 7, Their Cages. Even though I was getting a look for myself at life inside detention for separated children, the conditions of adults taken from their children were far from the headlines. Ava Bitron from the ACLU of Los Angeles, the first immigration attorney to get inside Victorville during family separations, helped me track down and understand the declaration of attorney Moonmeeth Kaur Soni from the Immigrant Defenders Law Center, filed on July 23, 2017, describing attempts to get inside the Victorville prison where Juan was detained. It was in those documents I learned of Toslowski's attempts to gain access to the facility, long before I met her. Before I toured the Ursula Border Patrol processing station, my conversations with Border Patrol Chief Padilla and his press attaché Robert Rodriguez were transcribed from a live stream video that picked up what was said by CBS Austin. Details of my tour of Ursula were like details of my tour of Casa Padre, straight from my notebook. Oprah Winfrey's voicemail to Dr. Colleen Kraft was shared with me by the American Academy of Pediatrics, which had been long advocating against family separations. I'm grateful to the organization, particularly Jamie Pulaski, for arranging a briefing for me at their Washington, D.C. offices about their work on family separations. Chapter 8, No Way to Link. Once public pressure and opposition to family separations in Washington reached a boiling point, the Trump administration was forced to act. But it wasn't just those outside the White House. Details of Ivanka Trump's direct advocacy against the policy to her father, specifically for him to sign an executive order ending it, were conveyed to me by a Trump administration official. Same goes for President Trump's phone call to Secretary Nielsen about ending the policy, and the Oval Office meeting that followed. Once the president ended separations by executive order, the reunification effort began almost immediately within the office of the HHS Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, and multiple sources with knowledge of the planning in those meetings described them to me. On the verge of being pushed out of the effort, Scott Lloyd sent an email about separation statistics to the group that would replace him, which was produced by House Energy and Commerce. The scene in the Secretary's Operations Center between Scott Lloyd, Commander White, and a third ORR employee in which tensions ran high was described and corroborated by multiple sources with knowledge of what occurred. I first reported about the email from HHS analyst Thomas Fitzgerald to Matt Albence at ICE on May 1, 2019 for NBC News in an article entitled "Emails Show Trump Admin Had No Way to Link Separated Migrant Children to Parents," and obtained the email from the House Judiciary Committee. Chapter 9. Shocks the Conscience. President Trump's ending systematic family separations by executive order was critical to ending the policy, but the decision by Judge Dana Sabraw was even more consequential. League Alert of the ACLU described the moment he learned he and his colleagues had prevailed over the Trump administration in the case, stopping the policy and ordering reunifications. The courtroom conversations between the Trump administration, Judge Sabraw, and the ACLU are from official court transcripts accessed online via Pacer. Details of the conditions inside Adelanto, the ICE detention center outside of Los Angeles, where Juan was transferred after Victorville, were described in the October 2018 DHS OIG report, Management Alert, Issues Requiring Action at the Adelanto ICE Processing Center in Adelanto, California. The July 15, 2018 incident in which separated children were made to wait overnight in vans outside the Port Isabel Detention Center were first reported by myself and Julia Ainsley on June 3, 2019, in our story for NBC News titled "Botched Family Reunifications Left Migrant Children Waiting in Vans Overnight." Details of what Jose experienced in the care and custody of BCFS Harlingen were described to me by him, and generally, by a representative for BCFS who explained what a day in the life of a child housed there would look like. Chapter 10. Made for TV Drama. Tensions were running high inside the Trump administration, and that was evident during the pressure-filled reunification process. The letter San Diego Sector Border Patrol Chief Rodney Scott, who's now leading the entire agency, sent to me, ended up on my desk at the NBC News Bureau at Universal Studios. I packed it away, deciding not to publish it at the time, but dug it out to paint a more complete picture of what was happening at the time for this book. I was personally present for the dialogue from the scene inside the San Diego courtroom of Judge Sabraw, but it too was based on court transcripts. The contentious murder board that took place on July 28, 2018, was recounted to me by multiple people present at the session. Chapter 11. It Hurts in My Heart. As summer 2018 wound down and deadlines for reunifications passed, the number of remaining cases began to shrink. That's when I first attempted to meet Juan with his attorney Lindsay Toslowski and Alfonso Maldonado Silva. Both of them worked with me then, and again as I wrote this book, to understand details of what occurred to their client and what it took for them to make contact with him. Details of Juan's asylum interview were based on the form filled out by his asylum officer, which, like other documents referenced in the book, were obtained with his permission. DHS spokeswoman Katie Waldman's trip to the border was described to me at the time by her personally and was also documented on her Instagram feed. Chapter 12. We Know That He Is a Good Person. Juan and Jose's reunification happened 4 months after their separation thanks to the dogged work of his attorneys. The letters sent vouching for him were also part of his case file I obtained with his permission, and the other details of the bittersweet reunion were described to me by father and son. Epilogue. The Greatest Human Rights Catastrophe of My Lifetime. The end of family separations was not the end of family separations, which I did not understand at the time. President Trump attempted on multiple occasions to restart family separations, first reported by my colleagues Julia Ainsley and Jeff Bennett in April 2019 after Trump fired Nielsen in a piece titled "Trump's Support of Renewed Child Separation Policy Led to Collision with Nielsen." The scene in which Trump, the First Lady and Nielsen discussed restarting the policy was described by a source with knowledge of the conversation. The president's remarks about the Alabama trip and details of his movements were documented in a live blog by the Auburn Plainsman. WSFA, in their report Alabama Welcomes Trump Days After Tornado Devastation, and the U.S. Army's Fort Benning Facebook page. Asked to respond to the exchange between the First Lady and President Trump, a spokeswoman for Mrs. Trump declined. Interstitials. I included the interstitials that appear in between each chapter of the book to take a step back and show how family separations unfolded in primary source material. The story of Anna in 2016 was from a Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service testimonial within the Betraying Family Values report assembled by KIND, the Women's Refugee Commission, and LIRS. The declarations of Miss C, Mr. U, Mr. A, and Miss MMAL were submitted by the ACLU as part of their Miss L versus ICE lawsuit. The significant incident reports about the separated 5-year-old from Guatemala and 9-year-old from El Salvador were uncovered through the aforementioned Freedom of Information Act request by the Center for Public Integrity, as was James De La Cruz's email to case managers on June 28, 2018, and the 2 complaints filed by the National Immigrant Justice Center to DHS's Department of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties about separated children and parents. Scott Lloyd's email on June 22, 2018, was part of the documents shared with me by the House Energy and Commerce Committee. The DHS OIG report, Initial Observations Regarding Family Separation Issues, was released publicly in September 2018. This is Jacob Soboroff. This production of Separated, Inside an American Tragedy, presented by Custom House and Harper Audio, was directed by Travis Tun. It was produced by Tim Bader Audio. Executive producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2020 by Jacob Soboroff. Production copyright 2020 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.